Yeah, well, both of us were involved in Surveyor 1, the first soft landing on the moon, which no one expected to be successful. They'd never had a successful flight of the Atlas Centaur up till then. And much to my amazement, when it was launched in the middle of the night. I rang Bruce Window about 7 a.m, fully expecting to say it had all been screwed up. And Bruce says, it's on its way.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So my job was in the ops world. But I'll let Keith talk first about what he remembers and what his role was.
Well, I can remember being there when it arrived. My shift was on when it landed. And I can remember everybody absolutely with bated breath waiting to see if after it touched down we still got a signal. And we did, and of course a great cheer went up. And there was no time wasted at all in getting some pictures, the first pictures. And the camera was pointed at the foot pad.
Mm. And a colour chart was in the same sort
exactly,
of view.
Exactly, there was a colour wheel mounted on it too. Yeah, and not that we could see it in colour, but it was there because I do believe that a sequential scan camera on there.
I think you're right.
And look, we were recording. We had FR 1400 half-inch tape recorders, which we ran at full speed, which I think was 120 IPS. And we also had an FR 800, which had been developed actually as a radar recorder.
Oh, yeah.
But which JPL had adapted to do video recording. It was a very temperamental beast and recorded on 2-inch tape. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the traditional helical scan.
Oh, it wasn't a helical head then.
It went through a gate and there was a very high-speed rotating head in the gate.
Oh, it was a rotating head.
But unlike the VR660, which had a great big drum, and it went over at an angle and around, this thing went straight through, so it was actually scanned across the tape.
Okay, but it was still cross-track or angle-track as opposed to linear.
Yes,
what the technical thing is.
And the advantage of that, of course, was because the heads were rotating at such a high speed that you didn't need to run the tape as quickly, and so a tape would last for quite a long time.
Do you remember seeing the Polaroids? You know,
yes, I got hundreds of them. I sent a whole bunch of them.
Oh, have you really? Yeah. I just had a few of them. And of course, the first ones were highly impressive. But as the days went by, we got more and more and more Polaroids, and somebody started pasting them into a quasi panorama.
Yeah, that was
overlapping.
Les Whaley did that.
Oh, did he? There were at least half a dozen people dedicated, Tim and Billa people, dedicated to Surveyor, but not in the prime position. There were four prime positions on Surveyor. There was the Hughes Sock. He had the grand title Sock. Sock 4-2.
Yeah.
So Surveyor Operations Chief, maybe. I don't know. Sock 4-2. And that was,
Hal French.
Too. Well done.
And then in front of him were these three specific consoles. The left-hand one was telemetry.
Yeah.
And that had lights and meters, and I think there was a way of programming that as to which parameters were displayed.
Yeah.
The middle console was the command.
It was?
Probably. I don't really remember that particularly well.
Yeah.
And the right-hand one, I think, was the video,
And it had a
camera on it. And a Polaroid-y type thing.
Yeah.
So they, certainly on Surveyor 1, the fellow on the left-hand one ended up at Honeysuckle in the computer.
Frank Hayne
was on the left-hand console.
Right.
And I'll never forget on the mid-course manoeuvre of Surveyor 1, Frank jumping up and down, we must have been in view for that manoeuvre, Frank jumping himself and said, just like the simulation, you know, because they had a way of simulating these. And it calmed down a bit because he did come over to Honeysuckle eventually on the computers. But he was quite a character. It was And a little anecdote in regard to Hal French. I, in my defence years, was on the new fighter selection mission in the late 70s, and Hughes aircraft made the radar in the F-16, I think it was. And so I visited El Segundo, and I said to the fellow who was showing me around, I said, you know, I used to know a number of people from Hughes who were at Tibbin Villa for surveyor. I said, in particular, I remember Hal French. And he looked him up and I said, he says, oh, it's still in the phone book, the Hughes phone book. I said, oh, right, well, can I go and see him? He says, well, not really. I said, no, look, here he is in the phone book. He whispered to me, he says, he's in Denver. By which I think I was meant to know that there was some more classified activity of Hughes, okay, physically at Denver. But he appeared in the phone book as if he was at El Segundo. Right. Anyway, I did get through to him, and I did talk to him, and that was in the late 70s. So that was, 14, 15 years later?
Yeah.
And he was still around then.
Yeah.
I had the joy, mind you, the very fact that we had all these Hughes people at Tibbin Villa irritated Bob Leslie immensely.
Yeah, I did.
Immensely.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget at 3 a.m. after some sort of simulation or whatever, I don't know how it felt to me, but I had to sit the Hughes people down and tell them as politely as I could, go home. I wasn't as blunt as that, but that was the message.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'd been tasked to do that.
Goodness me.
And I tried to insist, don't take this personally, but we are more than competent to do anything and everything that's needed to be done. That, in fact, was the maxim of the good old Department of Supply, and the politics of that era was that Australia was more than competent to do whatever was needed.
Yeah.
It did not need enforced US people to tell us what to do or how to do it.
Yeah.
And
I can sort of remember that.
Oh, and yeah. So they were all pleasant people, and I got, I knew them all well. I attended them at home one time. But Bob Leslie brought me up along those lines.
Yeah.
That, in fact, I got into trouble. When I first arrived, Bob Leslie was in hospital. He'd pulled his Achilles muscles playing cricket or something out there. And there was a request came through from Goddard for the people who were going to work in the wing at Tibbin Villa to go to Goddard for training. And we had to supply a list of candidate people, and Goddard would decide who would come for training. And me, in my naivety, fill those out and send them off. Well, when Bob Leslie got back to the station, he blew me up. I said, Mike, we don't do that.
Right.
We decide who goes, not Goddard.
Yeah.
And so he drilled, had two or three experiences along those lines.
Yeah.
And it was great, because not only was Bob Leslie like that, but the hierarchy of Department Supply was that way. Lloyd Bott, who was the Deputy Secretary of Department Supply, I credit him, I may go over the top, with setting the scene of the sovereignty of Australia vis-a-vis NASA, yeah, and that we were coordinated, worked together. We weren't in any way subject to NASA. Mm. It was an international treaty, and everything, and Australia did its thing.
Yeah.
And the maxim generally was, Mr. NASA, tell us what you want done.
We will do it,
and we'll tell you how much it cost.
Yeah.
But don't tell us how to do it.
Yeah.
If, by very strange possibility, we might need a little bit to know how to do it, we will ask, but don't thrust experience on us. Initially, JPL wanted to have their rep physically at the station at Tibbin Villa.
Really?
Mm. And Bob Leslie, at least among others, sort of scotched that.
Yeah.
Says, no, we're not going to have. And by the way, that was one of the little things that rankles me about the movie The Dish. The way they show the bloody NASA, so-called NASA rep, out there at the station, giving the impression, the wrong impression, that Mr. NASA sort of called the shots in some ways.
Yeah.
It was very much the opposite. They were encouraged to stay right on the side.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a bit of a digression from Surveyor 1. Anyway, as I say, Surveyor 1 astounded everybody. First of all, by it being launched successfully.
Yeah.
Secondly, it going onto a trajectory. Although I learned afterwards the Centaur, it was an Atlas Centaur rocket. The Centaur was meant to go into a parking orbit and then burn a second time for a lunar trajectory. But the very first mission I was involved in was AC-8, Atlas Centaur 8, which was a test flight, and it was unsuccessful. The Centaur did not ignite the second time. Therefore, when they did come to Surveyor 1, they didn't attempt to go for a second burn. They went for an Atlas Centaur direct trajectory to the moon. The ramification, the implication of that, I don't quite understand. It probably restricted the launch window compared with having a second burn.
Yeah.
So I was astounded when the Atlas Centaur worked. And then when I rang Bruce at the station, to my amazement, it was on its way. We weren't quite in view for the landing, but we were listening. It landed in Goldstone's view. That particular landing wasn't in our overlap Bruce view, but within, I think, half an hour, shortly.
Well, we were listening to it on that.
Exactly. Yeah. We were listening without doubt.
Yeah.
And we were all astounded. As you just said, that it landed, and there was a signal.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we had a source for that first picture. It must have got to us somehow or other. I can't remember how it would have. But I think
we actually must have taken a picture of that pad because
I'm pretty sure
I've sent one to Carl.
We did. When it rose onto Bimbilla, the camera was still pointing at the pad.
Okay.
And so SOC 4-2, what the fellow they then used to call himself, I can't remember. Surveyor something or other. SOC 4-2, send command, and the command person had to punch that in on a console, and I think that repeated back at his SOC console, and he'd say transmit or some word similar.
Yeah.
And so it was all live commanding. I don't think, any capability for remote commanding. I think it had to be done at the station from that command console.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we did, as soon as we were two-way, we did send commands to get the pictures.
Yeah.
And then, not only did it last, it land, it worked the first day, and everybody was pretty amazed at that, and the second, and the third, and the fourth, until it was coming up to lunar sunset, and everybody started saying, well, it plainly can't last through a lunar night. The battery will freeze and there's no way. Anyway, they put it to bed in whatever technology they had. But then, much to everybody's amazement, eventually they did retransmit, and it woke up again on the first lunar day. And that's when Paddy Johnson, who was on at the time, got this special award of, what was it? Sleeping Beauty or something like that. I wore the Sleeping Beauty.
Charming,
and there's a photo somewhere which Carl can produce that shows Paddy and I think Bob Leslie and Hal French getting this award. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think it might have lasted another lunar night. I'm not sure. Mind you, by that time, it had more or less done everything it could do. All it had was a camera. It really didn't have any other scientific...
It had a scope.
No, that one, did, not one, not, not Surveyor per, 1.
Okay, okay,
the Surveyor 1, as I recollect, was a camera only.
Yeah.
I certainly remember three having a scope.
Yeah.
And later ones had a so-called Alfred Scatter chemical... diviner thingy.
Yeah.
But Surveyor 1... Anyway, so Surveyor 1 was unbelievably successful.
Yeah.
Especially as Surveyor had a lot of drama in getting to that point.
Yeah,
it had cost an enormous amount.
Yeah.
And one other little anecdote. When I arrived at Tidbinbilla and Paddy Johnson showed me the Surveyor documentation, it was about a 10-foot shelf worth. I thought, book after book after book after book after book. And Paddy says, "Oh, don't worry, There's only a little bit in there that seemed relevant to us in his Irish accent.
Yeah.
And it was dead right. There was so much irrelevant all over the top.
Mike, do you remember which of the surveyors it was? It had finished everything they could think of it for it to do, and so they decided to move it?
I think it might have been three. It may have been others as well. Yeah. I was still at TID for three, and I do remember... Actually, three bounced. I think it was three that landed and bounced a little bit.
Right.
And so, fortuitously, they ended up with an image of the footpad in the sand. And it might have been...
One of the later ones, I know, they did shift it.
Yeah, they did. They did. It might have been after three.
Right.
So maybe the three I'm thinking of was the bounce, and maybe it was five. Each odd one failed. Surveyor 2 failed on its way. One of the vernier's engines stuck on, I think, after the mid-course correction, and it was tumbling.
Yeah.
And we were tracking at the time. And Frank Hain was doing his block about all this telemetry that was coming down. Anyway, eventually, Mr. JPL and or the Surveyor Projects decided we would just, for the hell of it, burn the descent engine and just kill it. And that command went from TID for Surveyor 2. So that was unsuccessful. And I think 4 was unsuccessful. I can't remember... I might have gotten to Honeysuckle by that stage. And then I think 5 was successful. But my sort of whole world then had shifted into the man flight Honeysuckle world.
Did you have any favourite memories of Surveyor?
It's such a long time ago, I can't be very specific, but I do absolutely remember, and I wish I knew which one it was, but I do remember... the debate that went on to actually try to fire the motor and see if we could move that one, whichever it was. And the fact that it actually did move and we didn't lose signal and then we were able to take pictures again. I think that probably supplied an awful lot of information that was useful leading up towards Apollo.
Yeah, it was certainly a precursor to Apollo from...
Yeah.
I'll tell you one other way it was a precursor to Apollo. It looked like we were going to end up with two surveyors on the moon at the same time, both transmitting on Channel 14. And we thought, how the hell are we going to cope with two signals coming down on the same frequency?
Yeah.
And we ran a simulation whereby we had a test transponder in the station, and we were live on the spacecraft, and the concept of pulling one frequency one way and the other frequency the other way.
Yeah, they used that in Apollo.
When I was running the ops at Apollo 13, and we had the IU and the LEM transmitting on the same frequency.
That's right.
I had talked to someone just before Apollo 13. I can't remember why. And so I, with complete confidence, says, well, obviously what you do is pull one way and pull one the other. As and when you've got them separated, which, of course, was not that simple.
Yeah.
And so we did that on Apollo 13. We got them separated.
Yeah.
And we're using the Surveyor experience. And then Mr. Houston says, we wanted to tune the uplink of so-and-so, so-and-so. And in such a way, we're going to bring them together again. And I screamed and very politely said to Mr. Houston, you're kidding. And I'd the USB one fella yelling in my ear, John Mitchell was shouting at me as well, saying, don't do it. And I called Goddard. I said, this won't work. And I said, Mr. Houston, it won't work. And the mentor said, stand by, and said, do it. I said, okay. We do it. And we did it, brought them together, and we're back where we were.
Yeah.
All messed up.
Yeah.
And I called Mr. Houston and said, look, the only way to get out of this is to get the lunar module to turn itself off for a little while. Let us pull the IU to one side and then turn the LEM on again.
Yeah.
And that's what they did.
Yeah.
That's what they did.
That's what I was
But
saying.
I only found out relatively recently the reason they wanted to do that tuning was to bring it back to nominal uplink frequency because the Doppler processing at Houston couldn't cope with a transmit frequency that was anything other than nominal, on the nominal amount. Which, and then there's a report on all this, but right at the end it says, however, it seems it could have been done, or worse to that effect,
right.
Because the tracking data that which left the station had the transmitter frequency as part of its data thing,
yeah.
And in future missions it did. Anyway, sorry, yeah. That was a slight digression from Surveyor, but it was all related to Surveyor, yeah. And it certainly gave me the confidence on Apollo 13, that Surveyor experience, yeah. of we never did have two, mind you, I think that might have been from, I don't know, 2 to 3 or 3 to 4, but there was a chance of having two on the moon at the same time.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And you're right, the later surveyors, one had certainly a scoop on it, and I'm fairly sure that was 3. And I think that same one had this, what was it called, alpha scattering, yeah. Something or other, which could analyze for elements.
Yeah.
I don't think there are any other scientific components of Surveyor that I remember anyway.
Yeah, lots of Polaroids that were taken of the surface and looking up at the Earth.
Yes.
And an eclipse, wasn't there? An eclipse of...
True.
The sun.
Yes, yeah, yes. There was an eclipse of it. Yep. I don't remember. Was it Surveyor 1? I think... I don't know if it was Surveyor 1 or 3 had an eclipse. One of them did.
I know that it happened, but I can't remember which.
It did.
Yeah.
Also, Paddy Johnson and I went out to try and work out where the hell it was on the moon. And we couldn't, because all the pictures you were seeing were northern hemisphere oriented.
Yeah.
And here we are in the southern hemisphere at a different latitude, and it's tilted like this. And we gave up, did Paddy and I.
Yeah.
So a lot was learnt on Surveyor, and of course it was the first lunar mission for Tibbenbilla. But in parallel with all this, by the way, Woomera 41 was tracking Lunar Orbiter. They were both flying about the same time,
yeah.
But we didn't have anything whatsoever to do with Lunar Orbiter.
Well, 41 also did the Ranger, didn't it?
True, yeah. The early Rangers,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think this... not being able to support was that we had this MDE. Let Keith talk to what MDE stands for.
It's a mission-dependent equipment.
And so that was...
It was
supplied by Hughes?
Yes. Yes.
The generality of MDE applied in that era to mission-dependent equipment. In other words, it was that equipment dedicated and needed for that particular spacecraft. And one of the early ones, which I think Keith was involved in with, was Pioneer 6. It had its own MDE.
Yeah.
Surveyor had its own MDE. And, of course, Lunar Orbiter did. But what it meant was that each station could only support... only a station with the MDE could support that spacecraft.
Yeah.
And Woomera had the MDE for Lunar Orbiter.
Yeah.
And Tibbenbilla for Surveyor.
So you had lots of Polaroids. There was some problem getting supplies?
It turned out they bought up every Polaroid there was in Canberra Queanbeyan during Surveyor 1.
Yeah.
And I think they sent people out hither and thither around Eastern Australia to buy Polaroid film or paper or whatever the term.
I had a Polaroid camera.
Did you really?
Oh, yes, which is where I got a lot of mine from, just from replaying tapes.
I see, yeah. I see. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, as did a few people. I think Les Whaley had one too. And, we would replay the tapes and...
But somehow or other. Yeah. In fact, I don't know if you've ever got it, seen it, Col. I've got a little mini, not a panorama, but I've got one of about 6 Polaroids that are sort of organised the sellotape has sort of shrunk and degraded. So I think that's Surveyor, Col.
Apollo, you went up to Parkes to support 3 missions?
Yes, I did, yes. After Mil Perrin decided he didn't want to go anymore. I was asked to go, and so I went. And I went initially with Harry Westwood, who wanted to show me the ropes, but I had to do. And he stayed up there pre-mission, but he came back and I stayed there for the mission. And from then on, I did that part on my own. And I missed out on Apollo 13. I would have loved to have been a part of that, because I reckoned, I've always thought that Apollo 13 was probably the biggest achievement of all of the Apollo missions.
Certainly from many points of view, yes.
Yes.
It was certainly the most stressful for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh.
But...
I live in a situation similar to yours, Mike, and I was asked to tell people, you know, about my experiences during the Apollo, and I spoke to them about it. But I said, when it comes to achieving something scientifically and engineering-wise, Apollo 13 takes the cake, and I really believe so.
Well, I often say that showed that the flexibility of skilled people and analog equipment,
yeah,
and initiative and that, dedication and experience,
yeah,
all sort of came together for everybody to do the best.
They probably wouldn't be able to do it now.
Well, you couldn't. No, yeah, exactly. I don't think anything like that. In fact, I don't think it could cope with many. The reason we could cope with that contingency was the flexibility of people,
yeah,
as computers.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, as I understand it, it's all computer-driven. Now, if the people who are written the software can visualise each and every possible failure mode and yeah, what you do about it,
then
fine.
Yeah.
But no one could do that.
No.
No one could do it. So there will definitely be limitations nowadays,
yeah,
compared with that era.
Yeah. It was quite fascinating because, you know, we were doing what we were asked to do all of the time. I mean, everybody on the station, not just the troops, but everybody, we were getting told, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But what was going on behind the scenes over there was, you know, amazing because...
Well, they're all everybody was busy.
Yeah.
And then you were so busy.
Yeah.
And you either knew explicitly or implicitly your part was as important as anybody else's.
Yeah.
Anybody else. If you didn't do your bit, yeah, no one else was going to do it for you.
No, exactly.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Tell me, how did you get on with CSIRO through those, you know, periods at Parks? Were they easy to get along with? Or
very.
Were they?
I found them very easy to get along with. Maybe they weren't quite so cooperative in the earlier days, but they got used to us, I think, and we to them. And no, we got along really well.
Do you remember any names from that era at all?
Well, there was Foxy, was the antenna driver, and John Bolton, of
John
course,
Bolton,
who was in charge. Those are the two that really stand out to me. But they were very amenable, I thought, anyway.
Yeah.
And we got along really, really well.
Well, that was my experience for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Not only then, but later on in the 80s when I was dealing with them in the deep space encounters of Voyager.
Yeah.
John Bolton had moved on by then, in the late 80s, I think. However, John Bolton and I had a bit of fun as to where the bloody first television step came from, because he'd been saying for years, and the Parkes Visitor Center had been saying for years, that Parkes supplied the first step of the moon. And I knew that wasn't true, but I didn't bother making an issue of it. But I got invited up there for 1989 for some reason or other. I think it was 20 years of Parkes, whatever. And so I had the joy of standing out in front of all the CSIRO people and saying, listen, I'm going to tell you what really happened. Anyway, after that, I got an email from whoever was the boss of Radio Physics then, said they were a little bit upset about me saying this, you know.
Oh.
And anyway, I happened to have a Net2 recording, which I think came from Bernie Scrivener, with the exact things that happened in the order of which they happened, and with me on Net2. And I got we've got the transcript on Col's website now. And I wrote to John Bolton, and I wrote to whoever the boss of...
Ron Eakers?
Ron Eakers, yes, who was boss of Radio Physics then, with all of this. And I, after fair little bit of time, I did get John Bolton, who wrote back and says, well, yes, I agree with you. I said, but I did say to him as carefully as I could, it really didn't matter. Everybody did what was needed with the equipment they have,
exactly,
with the view period they have,
exactly,
and whoever happened to support a particular phase was really neither here nor there.
Yeah.
We, honestly, I don't think we ever supported a landing, but we could have, and so the competence and capability was there all the time. So it gets, in some ways, it's ridiculous 50 years on, especially in all these decisions were being made in real time, as to who did what. Because one of John Bolton's statements was, oh, well, we had a signal on the offset feed at Parkes.
Right.
That was a secondary feed.
Yeah.
And that's where the picture came from. I said, well, John, it didn't. It didn't. I knew about the offset feed.
Yeah.
And I was advising Tom Reed, who was sitting on the console, Honeysuckle and the Sydney video people, say, don't go to Parkes yet because they're on the offset feed. There will be a glitch while they go from offset feed to main feed. I must admit, I had no idea how long that glitch would be, but I knew there would be a glitch, and we're getting a completely satisfactory signal at Honeysuckle and TID.
Yeah.
And, but John Bolton assumed, guessed, that offset feed signal going to Sydney was the one that was used.
Mm-hmm.
And had to prove, which I did eventually, that wasn't so. And not only wasn't it so, it was a decision on my part that would not be the way it was done.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's fun, especially we still debate the bloody thing 40, 50, 60, 70 years on. It's crazy. I love getting into the debate, but another part of me says, this is ridiculous.
You know.
Oh, and the other thing I will say to anybody who listen, television was at the bottom of my priority list compared with all the other important signals we were sending and receiving.
Yeah.
In fact, television didn't matter from the safety of the astronauts.
Yeah.
And just as the television came on, we had intermittent biomed signals at Honeysuckle. And I'll tell anybody who listen, my worry at that time was the biomed. It wasn't the television.
But right.
All we can talk about these days is television. And especially when we get this new laser way of tracking and we're going to get real-time 4K pictures via lasers. There we go. That should do you, Cole.